This talk, whoops, grows out of a seminar that I taught a year and a half ago on Chalmers's yay thick book, Constructing the World. It is an attempt to, come to terms with what I take the central thesis and argument of the book to be, which, as I'll be suggesting, I think the central argument is very problematic. So, for those of you who don't know about the book, the central thesis of the book is one that David calls generalized a priori scrutability. So here's what the thesis is. There's this base class of truths that he calls PQTI. You can think of this as a supervenience base, but as I'll explain in a minute, that's not really the right way to think of it. So there's a conjunction of all truths about physics, ultimately microphysics, whatever the right language of a completed physics is, qualitative truths about individual experience, truths, indexical truths about where one and when and who one is, and finally what he calls a that's all statement, which is supposed to indicate that the truths in the previous three classes exhaust all the truths of those types. So he then makes a bunch of claims about that look kind of like supervenience claims about what other truths follow from the truths in the base class. And the thesis of conditional scrutability is that all other truths follow from the truths in the base class. In particular, that for any truth S, the conditional if massive conjunction PQTI is true, then S, that conditional is knowable and therefore true. So minimally, in effect, S supervenes on PQTI, though note that the thesis is an epistemic one, not just a metaphysical one. So the stronger thesis of a priori scrutability, which says the same thing, except that the conditional in question is knowable a priori. And then generalized a priori scrutability. So this is the conjunction of all the truths of that type about the actual world. So generalized a priori scrutability is a thesis that corresponds for all other epistemically possible worlds. So for any epistemically possible combination of facts like this, all the other truths about that world follow a priori from that elementary combination of facts. So this is the thesis that Chalmers ultimately wants to argue for, though mostly I'll talk about a priori scrutability. So for example, just to give you an example, the thesis of a priori scrutability will imply that the conditional if massive conjunction of facts of those forms, then Elizabeth believes that Sider's conception of metaphysics is anti-feminist. So not only is it true that all the facts about who believes what supervene on this base class, but the facts about who believes what are a priori inferable from the facts in that base class. Okay, so it's an epistemic thesis, but it has the flavor of a supervenience thesis. But it's much stronger than a supervenience thesis because these facts can supervene on those facts and yet it'd be completely unknowable how they do so. Think McGinn or think Davidson, that sort of thing. Okay, so why is this thesis important? Well, what Chalmers is really up to is trying to get some reconstruction of something like a Phrygian notion of sense in terms of what he calls epistemic intentions. Epistemic intentions are, like all intentions, functions from possible worlds to truth values, but they are epistemic in the sense that the worlds in question are epistemically possible worlds, not metaphysically possible worlds. The epistemically possible worlds are essentially identified with maximal consistent sets of microphysical, qualitative, indexical information. And so generalized a priori scrutability will guarantee that all the truths about any epistemically possible world are a priori inferable from the base information that characterizes it. If you're familiar with Lewis's worries about talking donkeys and that sort of thing, and sort of how we should think of what characterizes a possible world, this is a kind of response to that. So if it's going to be true that the microphysical, qualitative, and indexical information about the world determines a priori the truth values of all other sentences, then there needs to be an extraordinary number of a priori connections between the kinds of concepts that don't figure in the base information, namely almost all concepts, and the truths that do. Okay, so that's the a priori connections between, say, physical, qualitative, and indexical information and moral facts. There have to be a priori connections between that information and mentalistic facts and semantic facts and any other kind of fact that you'd like to throw in there. Now, in fact, the idea is that the sort of different kinds of concepts form a hierarchy, and each one's going to get reduced to a lower one. Okay, but nonetheless, the connecting principles here all have to be a priori. And the connecting principles are what I will call level-crossing principles. You can think of them as sort of taking you up a level in the hierarchy each time. Okay. Dang. What on earth is happening? Well, okay. This thing is a little fishy. Okay. Sorry. All right, so also when you hit it once, it wants to do like four. All right. So the central argument of the book, as I see it, comes in chapter four. And it's what Chalmers calls the front-loading argument. It's an argument whose purpose is specifically to take us from the thesis of conditional scrutability, which has been argued for in chapter 3, to the thesis of a priori scrutability. So Chalmers takes himself to have shown in chapter 3 that for any truth at all, S, the conditional if P, Q, P, I, and S will be knowable. And he's attempting to establish that the conditional is in fact knowable a priori. So suppose that this is true. I mean, there are all kinds of questions one can raise, obviously, about the arguments of chapter 3, but we're setting that aside. So suppose that conditional scrutability has been established. So we know that conditional if P, Q, T, I, then S is knowable. Think of S as maybe involving claims about knowledge or claims about moral truths or whatever it might be. Something that's not included in the base facts. Now, the reason that this conditional might not be known a priori is that knowledge of the conditional might depend upon what Chalmers pretty consistently calls background empirical evidence. So there's this thought experiment where you sort of imagine yourself having access to all this information about physical facts and so forth, and you consider a question like, who was Jack the Ripper? And you're supposed to be able to convince yourself that if you had all this information, you could figure out who Jack the Ripper was. And the thought is that in the process of doing that, you might be relying upon all kinds of background information that's available to you that actually isn't included in this specification. So, and this is not me, this is Chalmers, basically. Right? That's what the argument leaves open, is that there's this possibility of reliance upon background information. So let E be that additional background information. Then the idea of the front-loading argument is to take E and stick it into the antecedent of the conditional. So previously, we knew this conditional on the basis of the background information. So take the background information, stick it into the antecedent of the conditional, and then the claim is that since E was the total additional empirical evidence on which your knowledge of conditional rested, once you front-load it, that conditional is now known a priori. That's it. All right. So, I mean, to say, and lots of people have said, it's one of these arguments that takes about 3 sentences to state. Think, yeah, that doesn't seem so bad. Lots of defenses of this, lots of discussion of this in the book. Now, you might have some worries about this. The first worry is that, if you go back to this, so E here is sort of background knowledge that you had that you appealed to when you were evaluating this conditional. When I front load it by putting it into the conditional, it's no longer acting as known. It's acting as merely something that I'm supposing to be true as a conditional supposition in trying to reach the conclusion S. So you might think, look, when you front load like this, you're shifting from a situation where you had something that was known to something, a situation in which it's merely supposed. And you might think that knowledge has a greater epistemic force than mere supposition. Moreover, you might think that if E was some perceptual evidence that you had, it's not even clear what it is to suppose perceptual evidence. I mean, supposing that P is different from supposing that I believe that P, supposing perceptual evidence is different from supposing that I have the perceptual evidence, it's not clear how to make the difference out of that case. So several people, there are long discussions of this in the book. There are lengthy discussions by some commentators, Ron Nita and Laura Schroeder in particular. And I'm profoundly sympathetic to this, but I'm hunting different prey. I'm just ignoring this because I'm after something else. Okay, so there's a really obvious worry about the arguments that's been articulated so far. This was what was supposed to be shown, right? That conditional was knowable a priori. This is what we got, right? That the conditional if P speaks to I and background evidence E, then S, that's knowable a priori. So the argument just doesn't, as stated so far, establish the conclusion that it was meant to establish. Now, one way to think of this is to say that when we front-loaded E, we potentially expanded this base class of truths. If E itself had been part of PQTI, if E itself included microphysical information and indexical information, that kind of thing, then of course E would just be incorporated into PQTI, and then we'd get the conclusion. And moreover, Charmer says at one point, even if E isn't part of PQTI, if the kinds of things that can be included in E are constrained in form, then you would have an a priori scrutability claim, but not the a priori scrutability claim. I mean, maybe you need to throw in, I don't know, moral facts or something, have a larger base. So here's a little quote where he makes it very clear. He says, only if basic empirical evidence, that is, the kinds of things that could be included in E, is open-ended. For example, if one must make irreducible appeal to evidence sentences about water, kangaroos, trees, and so on, will there be a problem for a priori scrutability? And if absolutely anything could turn up in here, then sort of absolutely everything is getting tossed into the antecedent. And no interesting thesis remains. So, the central worry, I mean, dialectically speaking, I mean, someone who's skeptical about what's going on here, the worry that you're going to have is precisely this, that what kind of background knowledge you might have to appeal to in evaluating these conditionals could be absolutely anything. It's not constrained in form. And if that's so, then once you front load all this stuff, you just, in effect, have all the truths being known on the basis of all the truths or something, and that's nothing interesting. All right, so let me just say that a bit more because it's important. So what Chalmers calls a scrutability thesis, there are many varieties of these, definitional, inferential, conditional, a priori, and even more. What a scrutability thesis is a claim to the effect that all the truths are in some sense derivable from, knowable on the basis of, something like that, some more limited class of truths. Chalmers has a particular view about what the limited class of truths is, but you can imagine other forms of this view. Now, on any such view, there are going to be lots of truths concerning water, trees, cats, people, kangaroos, and the like, that aren't part of the base. So to recapture those truths, you have to show how it is that they can be known on the basis of or derived from or whatever it is, the more fundamental sorts of truths, whatever you think those are. And this is the way that Chalmers highlights at the beginning of the book, which is apparently pointed out to him by Steve Yablo, in which his project is eerily reminiscent of Carnap's project in the alphabet. So Carnap held that all of our concepts form a hierarchy. At the lowest level of the hierarchy, at least according to the main view of the Carnap, are purely phenomenological facts. And Carnap then attempts to show how physical facts, all the way up through all the different kinds of concepts we have, can be rigorously defined in logical terms on the basis of the lower level concepts. Right? Ultimately, everything can be rigorously logically defined in terms of phenomenological notions. Now, Chalmers is not trying to do quite that. For one thing, he's prepared to admit a lot more into the base than Carnap was. For Carnap, it was basically Q, just sort of qualitative facts about experience. And if Chalmers isn't trying to show how to define other higher-level concepts in terms of lower-level concepts, rather, he's just trying to show how, in some sense, the higher-level stuff can be epistemically reduced to the lower-level stuff, in the sense that the higher-level stuff can be known on the basis of the lower-level stuff. Okay, but nonetheless, okay, the crucial problem is this problem of getting from lower levels to higher levels. Right? That's always the problem with programs like this. So in the case we're talking about, the objection we're talking about, the crucial form of the objection, the worry about front-loading, is always going to be that the background knowledge you're appealing to traffics in exactly the same sorts of conceptual resources you were trying to reduce in the first place. Right? So you're trying to reduce moral notions, but it turns out that the background knowledge you were appealing to when you did it involved moral principles. Right? Or you're trying to reduce epistemic notions, and it turned out that the background knowledge you were appealing to when you did it involved epistemic principles. Okay. So I have to apologize. I know that this is all ludicrously abstract. Okay? This is a major, major problem with this book. It is unbelievably abstract. There are almost no examples in the book. There is one. And Chalmers makes an enormous amount of it. So I'm going to talk about it. I mean, part of the problem is that the person who's meant to be in the business of knowing these conditionals is this godlike idealization of ourselves. So having examples about these godlike idealizations of ourselves are probably a little hard to come up with. There's a person who knows all mathematical facts, for example, truths, instantaneously. Okay, so the one example that Chalmers does talk about are Gettier cases. And he claims that our experience with Gettier cases provides prima facie support for the idea that facts about knowledge epistemically reduce to facts that don't involve knowledge. So here's the idea. So let G be the description of some Gettier case, say from Gettier's original paper. Let K be the claim that the subject in such a case knows whatever fact is at issue. It's a barn. So suppose that your response to the case is to make the judgment that if the facts of Gettier's case were to obtain, then the subject would not know. Right? Here's what Chalmers says. It's plausible that one could know this material conditional a priori. Someone who knows that G is true and who has mastered the concepts involved in K, in particular the concept of knowledge, is thereby in a position to know that K is false, even if they lack any further relevant empirical information. So the claim is that when you make the judgment in the Gettier case that the subject doesn't know, you're deriving that a priori from the description of the case. That's the argument. It more or less rests on the observation that nobody, when given the description of a Gettier case, decides that they need to go do some extra investigation before they can come to a judgment. problem is that this comes nowhere near showing that the judgment is a priori, because there's no reason whatsoever to think that the judgment you're making doesn't rest upon background information that you had when the description of the case was given to you. In particular, that the judgment rests upon things that you happen to know about knowledge. It's a complete non sequitur. There's really a sort of nasty ambiguity in the word further, right? Later in the book, Chalmers says, oh yeah, I guess not. So I didn't really mean it. So he never really takes it back. Okay, so the worry, so this is meant to illustrate the sort of dialectic from before. This is the more basic stuff, non-knowledge involving information. The description of the Gettier case isn't given in terms of what anybody knows, doesn't know. Here's a claim about knowledge, right? So the claim is supposed to be the knowledge claims are following a priori from the non-knowledge involving claims. And I've raised the worry that, maybe not, right? Maybe there was this background information about knowledge that you were appealing to when you evaluated the condition. So, front level, right? Take that background information, stick it into the antecedent of the conditional. So this may not be a priori, but that is. Sorry, I'm making it. Okay, but now the thought is that, look, I mean, someone who is worried about whether it's a priori or not thinks that E involves knowledge, right? Various principles about knowledge are being exploited when you make the Gettier judgment. Are these specific facts about knowledge? Well, probably not. Quite, they're probably generalizations about knowledge that you've come to accept on the basis of your experience with knowledge over the years. But if that's right, then our experience with data cases gives us no reason whatsoever to think that facts about knowledge reduce to more basic sorts of facts, that they a priori reduce. I mean, it may be that such things are knowable, that knowledge facts are knowable on the basis of non-knowledge involving facts, but only against this background knowledge about knowledge that you have. So the lesson is that this maneuver of front-loading background information by itself does absolutely nothing to establish a priori superiority. Nothing. I think I'll skip that. I'll just say quickly, so I'm going to ask about this later if you want. You might think, well, at least there's an a priori truth there, right? Bad for Quine. Not so bad. Okay. So, none of this is news to Chalmers. He says all of this himself, more or less. I'm emphasizing a little bit more than he does. He's aware of this. So he suggests that what we should do is invoke something that he calls the core knowability thesis. Core knowability thesis is introduced in chapter 3. It's part of the argument for conditional superiority. And it is that all knowable ordinary truths are knowable with grounds in what Chalmers calls core evidence. Core evidence, in turn, consists of introspective evidence that you have about your own phenomenal states, and whatever perceptual evidence you may have about the distribution of primary and secondary qualities in your environment. Right? So it's a very, very limited sort of evidence. If you believe in such things as perceptual evidence that there are trees, it does include that. Okay. Only very basic perceptual evidence about primary and secondary qualities, plus introspective evidence about your phenomenal space. Right? So the claim is that anything that you can know solely on this basis. Basic core evidence. So note that I said earlier that there's this worry that basic empirical evidence might be open-ended, right? And because it's open-ended, anything at all could turn up in E. Then we run into this big problem. This is a thesis that's supposed to have the effect of saying, well, no, but basic evidence doesn't have to be open-ended. Basic empirical evidence, in principle, could consist only of facts about introspection and this elementary perceptual stuff. Okay. So, with this in hand, I won't question this. I'm going to question how it's used. With this in hand, we can now produce the following argument. And this is what I call the front-loaded argument. So, on page 161 and 162 of the book, section 4.2, and it goes as follows, and it takes up about a paragraph. Okay, so, from the thesis of conditional scrutability, we know that that conditional is knowable. So, since it's knowable, this principle tells us that it's knowable with grounds in core evidence, C. That is some perceptual stuff, some introspective stuff. So, forget about E. Right? Front load C instead. So, that conditional now is a priori. Now you argue as follows. Basically, the idea is that C is part of PQTI, or it's determined by it. And we can see that quite easily. So, one here is evidence, introspective evidence about your phenomenal states. Okay? But what your phenomenal states are is included in the qualitative part of PQTI. Right? So what you've really got in one is evidence about Q. And the facts about Q are better than evidence about those facts. So Q is sort of incorporates one, is the idea. Moreover, the facts about the primary qualities are included in P, the physical facts. And again, having the facts is better than having evidence about the facts. And finally, the facts about secondary qualities are a priori scrutable, Chalmers says, from the PQTI base, that the physical facts and qualitative facts and so forth a priori determine the facts about the secondary qualities. Okay, so in effect, what this all comes to is that the PQTI facts a priori determine the core evidence facts. Hence, the conditional PQTI follows a priori from PQTI. I mean, in effect, what you've got is PQTI and C implies S, PQTI implies C, so PQTI implies S. And since all that was known, since the two antecedent conditionals were known a priori, so is the conclusion. That's the point. I'll emphasize just quickly that it's critical right here that the truths about secondary qualities are a priori scrutable. It wouldn't be enough for the truths about secondary qualities to be conditionally scrutable from PQTI, because then, I mean, PQTI then C would be knowable, but not knowable a priori. Because right? The secondary quality facts wouldn't follow a priori from the PQTI facts. They're just, they'd follow from them, but not a priori. All the things that your right, logical inference is supposed to preserve a priori truth, that the conditionals that you're inferring from aren't known a priori, the conclusion you get won't be known a priori. Okay. All right, so I'm going to suggest that there is a gaping hole in the middle of this argument. It's easier to see it if you consider a different argument. Here's the different argument. So, go back to E again. Front load. So that conditional is a priori. Okay, now, by the core knowledge knowability thesis, E itself will be knowable on the basis of certain core evidence, C. Right? So the conditional if C then E will be knowable. Moreover, by the argument at the bottom there, C is screwable from PQTI itself, so the conditional if PQTI then C is knowable. But PQTI then S, PQTI then C, and C then E all together imply if PQTI then S. Okay, but that wasn't what we wanted, right? What we want is for this to be a priori. And if this is going to be a priori, then that has to be a priori, that has to be a priori, and that has to be a priori. I mean, it could be a priori without them being a priori, but if you're going to derive it this way, you got to know that they're a priori. Now, I'm granting, more or less, this is a priori, I'll prepare to grant this, prepare to grant that, but what about this? Why do you think, why is that supposed to be a priori? It came from the core nobility thesis, which told us that any noble truth is noble on the basis of core evidence. But note that if that principle now is going to deliver the conclusion that this is noble a priori, it has to be understood in the following strong form: that any noble ordinary truth is noble with grounds in core evidence, with no dependence whatsoever upon any kind of background knowledge or information. If it were possible that when you knew E on the basis of C, you did so only against the background of other background information, you know, relying upon other background information you had, then you wouldn't know if C and E a priori. You would know it only on the basis of this background information you had, whatever that might be. So in effect, the claim of the thought is that given that CKT is supposed to imply that this is a priori, it has to exclude the possibility of reliance upon background evidence, background knowledge. This principle, in turn, immediately implies this principle, what I'll call the core scrutability thesis. That all ordinary noble truths are a priori scrutable from what I will call Q12. The facts about qualitative experience, primary and secondary qualities. Remember, the core nobility thesis said that any ordinary noble truth is noble on the basis of core evidence, that is, facts about, introspective facts about qualitative experience, perceptual facts about phenomenal primary and secondary qualities. But again, I mean, the same thought that Chalmers had, I'm just cribbing off him, the facts about qualitative experience, primary and secondary qualities are at least as good as evidence about those facts. So if E is knowable on the basis of C, then it's certainly knowable on the basis of the qualitative, primary, and secondary facts. And since we've excluded now any appeal to background evidence when we've strengthened CKT to CKT+, we know that all such truths are noble a priori on that basis. Now, the worry is basically that this principle is already stronger than the principle Chalmers was trying to establish. Right? I know this is too abstract. So the thought is, look, the front-loading argument is supposed to establish a priori scrutability. The front-loading argument, I have now argued, needs this strong principle in order to work. But this strong principle already by itself implies this principle, which is stronger than the conclusion Chalmers is arguing for. So the front-loading argument is a sideshow. I mean, it assumes and uses principles that are stronger than what it is actually being used to show. Now, this principle differs from Chalmers' a priori scrutability thesis in two ways. Chalmers' says all truths are. This says all ordinary noble truths are. But for one thing, the core issues here concern ordinary noble truths. I can explain why it is later. And moreover, the restriction to ordinary noble truths in CKT has to be lifted anyway if it's going to do the work it needs to do. That's a different thing. So that's turned out to be irrelevant. Right? And then there's another difference, which is the difference in the base. Right? Chalmers' base is PQTI. My base is Q12. But it seems to me that this, you know, the claim that all truths are a priori scrutable from qualitative, primary, and secondary facts is a much stronger claim that they're a priori scrutable from microphysical, qualitative, and indexable facts. I mean, for example, in Chalmers' discussion of how you can know on the basis of the PQTI stuff that water is H2O, he makes repeated reference to the importance of physical facts, right? Like chemical composition and stuff like that. But that's no part of this. Right? So this just looks, I mean, not only is this at least as strong as Chalmers' thesis, it looks to me to be vastly stronger. Okay, so the intermediate conclusion is that using CKT plus to argue for a priori scrutability is dialectically hopeless. It's actually a stronger principle than what you're using it to argue for. I will skip that. So here's the dilemma that Chalmers faces according to me. There are two possibilities. The first is that the core nullability thesis leaves open the possibility that E, or this conditional, depending on which version of the argument you're talking about, it can be known on the basis of core evidence, but that knowledge itself might depend upon additional background knowledge. That's one possibility. If that's the way it goes, then this won't be a priori. It'll still depend upon some other background knowledge. The other possibility is that CKT is being understood in such a way that it doesn't leave open the possibility of additional background knowledge. But if that's the way it goes, then CKT is already sufficient to imply what I call the core scrutability thesis, which is arguably stronger than the thesis that Chalmers is arguing for, and appealing to it in the course of the front-loading argument is hopeless. Okay, now, So, there's an obvious idea, and that's to try iterating the process. So here's the idea. So P gives you M was supposed to be nullable, sorry, I changed notation. M is supposed to be conditionally scrutable from PQTI. But it depends, it's only conditionally scrutable because it depends upon its background knowledge E0. E0, in turn, is knowable on the basis of some core evidence C0, but maybe only on the background of basis of background knowledge E1. E1, in turn, is knowable on the basis of core evidence, but maybe there's some more background knowledge E2. Keep going. Right? Iterate the process. Now, one possibility is that the chain of dependencies here is infinite, that this never bottoms out. Right? Every time a new piece of background evidence pops up, it can always be known on the basis of some core evidence, but that just throws up a new piece of background knowledge that has to be known on the basis of other core evidence, and it goes all the way down. You might think, oh, what about the infinite conjunction of all that core evidence? What if we just infinitely conjoined all of those things? Wouldn't that then do the trick? Answer, no, but I'll skip that. No. Okay, another possibility, the more interesting possibility, is that the iteration terminates. Some point you run into some core evidence, you run into some piece of background knowledge that can be known on the basis of core evidence with no appeal to background knowledge. If that's what happens, then front load all the E's to get these here conditionals. They're all knowable a priori. And all of these conditionals together will imply if PQTI then right? Exercise in the first order. Truth functional. So if you had some reason to believe that this process must terminate, that the background knowledge to which it's in principle, on which it's in principle possible to rely in knowing these things is finite, then maybe you would have an argument. So maybe that's what Chalmers was thinking. We're finite beings. It's hard to evaluate this because the beings who are in the business of knowing these things are these super godlike beings that know all mathematical facts at once. So I don't know what kind of background knowledge is possible for them to have. Tough to know. Okay? But the real danger here is not the infinite descendants thing. Okay? It's rather a more general worry that the chain of dependencies might be what logicians call non-well-founded. Okay? Being infinitely descending like this is one way of being non-well-founded, but it's not the only way. The other way is to be essentially circular. So consider again this iterating idea. Each piece of background knowledge pops up, some piece of core evidence on the basis of which it's knowable, new piece of background knowledge pops up. The question is, how do we know that say, at the second stage, the background knowledge here, on the basis of which E1 was being known, isn't just E0 again. I mean, M was knowable on the basis of PQTI with background knowledge E0, E0 is knowable on the basis of coordinate C0 with background knowledge E1, E1 is knowable on the basis of C1 with background knowledge, couldn't it be E0 again? So that would give us a situation like this. So what this says is what it said. Now, you can front load to get these conditionals. But now it's easy to see that even if C0 and C1 are both true, and these conditionals are both true, it could be that the E's are all false. Right? In particular, if the conditionals are material, and C0 and C1 are both true, and E of 0 and E1 are both false, the conditionals are both true. So C0 and C1 do not together imply E0 or E1, or let alone their conjunction. So we have no reason to believe that actually that should be C0 and C1 is knowable a priori. There's no argument from this to anything about a priori knowledge of anything special. Okay, now, the worry might be that there's something circular about this situation. I mean, here I am, I know E0 on the basis of C0. I mean, I know E0 with grounds and core evidence C0, but I have an appeal to background knowledge E1 to know that. And here I am knowing E1 on the basis of C1, but with background knowledge E0. I mean, isn't there something circular about it? And the answer is no. There might be something circular about it if I was claiming that someone actually knew E0 and E1 in this way. That knowledge of E0, your actual knowledge of E0 depended on your background knowledge that E1 was true, and your actual knowledge of E1 depended on your background knowledge that E0 was true. It would look like, look, you got to know one of them first, and then you get to know the other one, but they're just running in a little circle. Right, so somebody who thought that this was the situation of how people actually do these things might have a problem. But that's not at all what's being claimed. It's not at all what's at issue here. The core knowability thesis, which I'm accepting for the purpose of argument, tells us that E0 is knowable on the basis of core evidence C0. And that E1 is knowable on the basis of core evidence C1. There's not even a claim that both of these things are simultaneously knowable. It's just that each of them is knowable that way. Right? So there's no suggestion anyone actually knows anything in this circular way. Moreover, many of us think that very little of our actual knowledge is based on what Chalmers calls core evidence. That in fact, most of our actual knowledge is based on something else, richer perceptual experience or something of the sort. Indeed, Chalmers distinguishes the core evidence, the core knowledge thesis, from what he calls the core evidence thesis. The core evidence thesis is that all knowledge is in fact grounded in core evidence. That's a much stronger thesis than the thesis that all knowledge is in principle possible could be grounded in core evidence. Right? And he thinks, in fact, that the weaker thesis is plausible in ways that the stronger thesis is not. So it's not that this is how we know it, it's just if we were only to rely on core evidence, this is how we would have to know it. But if you think we rarely know anything on the basis of core evidence, you think these kinds of claims just aren't that interesting or important. If there's a circularity there, it doesn't matter because that's not actually how we know anything. These are claims, as I said, that Chalmers needs to make, not claims that I need to care. So, I think this is actually where I've lost a lot of this, but I think this is probably where, I think Chalmers overlooks this possibility. I think that's what the problem with the argument ultimately is. So, a couple of concluding remarks. Let me just try to give you the summary of the example again. So, is knowledge of that conditional a priori? Well, maybe it's based on some background evidence. So front load. But that doesn't help because E might have involved claims about knowledge. So Chalmers says, well, invoke the core knowability thesis. Okay, one way to do that is to claim that E, the background knowledge, is itself knowable on the basis of some core evidence C. So the claim will be that if C then E is knowable a priori. But if that's right, then look, E, the worry was that E trafficked in claims about knowledge and so forth. But now this core knowledge thesis is telling us that claims about knowledge are a priori knowable on the basis of core evidence. It's telling us that by itself. So we're done. We don't need the front load warning to get this conclusion. Okay, Chalmers gives what's a slightly different argument. Instead of saying, oh, front load E, he says, well, the conditional is knowable on the basis of core evidence, so front load that, etc., etc. But it still requires appeal to the stronger thesis that the argument is to work. And so my conclusion is that this front loading thing, as interesting as it may be for other reasons, it's not up to me to say, it's dialectically powerless as an argument for core scrutability, for a priori scrutability, because it depends upon, if it's going to work, this thesis that is sufficient by itself to entail that. And that's the end.